The United States says it is re-evaluating its relationship with Saudi Arabia following a decision by OPEC Plus to slash oil output. Russia says the US is de facto involved in the war in Ukraine, warning that the supply of advanced air defense systems to Kiev will only extend the conflict. Also in the headlines, a major French trade union warns against any government intervention to end refinery strikes as fuel shortage crisis deepens across the country. Welcome to World News from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Now, top story this hour, tensions are escalating between the United States and Saudi Arabia after OPEC and other oil-producing countries announced an output cut. Washington says it is now re-evaluating its relationship with Riyadh. The White House National Security spokesman says President Joe Biden is willing to work with Congress on the future of Saudi relations. John Kirby says talks on the matter will start right away. Earlier, Senator Bob Menendez called the government to limit arms sales and military cooperation with Saudi Arabia. Three legislators have already introduced a bill to withdraw troops and missile systems from the kingdom. Riyadh has, however, defended its decision for oil production cuts, saying OPEC has a pivotal role in achieving balance and stability in global markets. Recently, the 23 countries, together known as OPEC Plus, agreed to reduce the output by 2 million barrels per day from November. That's despite Washington's call for an increase in output. Russia has once again warned against the U.S. arming of Ukraine, saying the military aid coming to Kiev will only prolong the conflict. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says U.S. military aid will not change Moscow's goals in its military operation in Ukraine. And meanwhile, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov accused the U.S. of making false claims that it is open to negotiations and advocates a political solution. Lavrov said the U.S. continues to send arms to Ukraine without making any serious efforts to contact Moscow to resolve the conflict. Lavrov further said that the U.S. is already de facto involved in the Ukraine war.
It seems to me that the Americans have been participating de facto in this war for a long time. They're not only weaponizing Zelensky and his regime, they're providing satellite intelligence, including not only dozens of military satellites, but hundreds of commercial satellites, which are now being used in service of military plans of support of the neo-Nazi regime.
The remarks came after Washington and its Western allies pledged more support for Ukraine. Canada announced it would send 40 more combat engineers to Poland to help train Ukrainian forces. U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington would supply advanced air defense systems following Russia's largest missile strikes on Ukraine to date. Russia has vowed to respond to the West's growing involvement in the Ukraine conflict. Washington has been one of the biggest suppliers of weapons to Kiev since the beginning of the war. The U.S. has given the military aid worth around $17 billion so far. Meanwhile, Russia says it has conducted new strikes on Ukraine's energy infrastructures a day after targeting the capital Kiev and several other cities with missiles.
The armed forces of the Russian Federation today continued a massive air and sea strike with long-range precision weapons against Ukrainian military control and energy system facilities. The purpose of the strike has been achieved.
The Russian Defense Ministry spokesman added that all the targeted energy facilities in Ukraine have been destroyed. Russian strikes over the past 2 days have left large swathes of the country without power. These are the biggest attacks since the start of the Russian military offensive in Ukraine back in February. Kiev has once again urged Western leaders to provide it with more air defense systems to counter Russia. Moscow has repeatedly blasted Western military aid to Ukraine, saying the deliveries only fuel the flame of conflicts. France's major trade union has threatened war against President Emmanuel Macron if his administration forces striking refinery staff back to work. The warning from the General Confederation of Labour, or CGT, union comes after the government threatened to intervene to end the weeks-long walkout that has caused a fuel shortage in the country. Earlier, Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire said the government would not allow the blockades on refineries to last. He also threatened strikers with requisition measures if fuel depots were not reopened soon. The industrial action over pay dispute has taken 60% of French refining capacity offline. This has led to a shortage in a third of gas stations nationwide. The walkout has worsened the energy crisis and inflation, as France is already reeling from the impact of the war in Ukraine.
The French leaders have seemingly found a solution to the country's energy crisis. Puffer jackets and turtlenecks have become the newest fashion trend in the Élysée, as ministers and the president try to imply a message to the public: wrap up warm for winter. That's while, as the cold season approaches, the nation struggles to afford heating. French motorists have been made to wait in long lines across the country to refuel their vehicles as petrol pumps run dry amid ongoing strikes at the country's oil refineries and storage sites. Almost a third of the petrol stations had problems getting deliveries of fuel as tanker drivers continue their strike over low wages and harsh working conditions amid a cost-of-living crisis in France. So, to cut the long story short, Macron is up to his neck in trouble, and his government's winter wardrobe messaging has drawn accusations of being out of touch with everyday reality. The country's far-right opposition leader, Marine Le Pen, mocked the government saying, "Don't have enough heating? Let them wear cashmere." And Gaspard Ganser, an advisor to former president François Hollande, labeled the idea grotesque and paternalistic. Paris has come up with an energy efficiency plan to get through the winter without blackouts. Homes and offices heated to a maximum of 19 Celsius degrees. No hot water in public buildings, no lit advertising overnight, a ban on doors left open in heated or air-conditioned shops, reduced temperatures in swimming pools and gyms. These are some examples of the action France is taking to save energy. However, environmentalists have accused the French government of promoting tiny measures while failing to take enough action on the climate crisis. They say unenforced and voluntary measures are ineffective. Also, scores of French intellectuals have urged the nation to rise in protest against President Emmanuel Macron's failure to improve economic conditions amid rising inflation. The current situation troubles the French government as a foretaste of problems to come, a potential winter of discontent. Now, the question is, will Macron get his head out of his turtleneck?
Europe, which largely relied on Russian gas, lacks alternatives ahead of the winter. The crisis that coincided with the Ukraine conflict has also led to growing anti-NATO sentiments. Thousands of protesters gathered in Paris to call on the government to end the country's membership in the Western military alliance. And many believe that NATO's anti-Russia stance has been the cause of the energy crisis the continent is struggling with.
Thousands of demonstrators gathered in Paris to protest soaring inflation and high cost of living, demanding that France pull out completely from membership in the US-led NATO military alliance. They demanded that President Emmanuel Macron resign, calling on his government to stop supplying arms to Ukraine. Ever since the Ukrainian crisis began, causing a severe energy crisis across Europe, anti-NATO sentiments have been rising among Europeans. Similar protests have been held across the European Union against soaring inflation and the rising cost of living caused by sanctions imposed on Russia in the wake of the Ukraine war. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine in late February, Western countries have slapped waves of sanctions on Russia. In response, Moscow has either choked up or lessened its gas exports to the rest of Europe, saying it would only resume the gas flow after the economic sanctions were lifted. Disruption in supply chains has led to higher fuel and food prices across the EU.
driving inflation to record levels and causing the cost of living to soar. The European Union leaders accused the Kremlin of wielding energy as a weapon, cutting gas supplies in retaliation for sanctions. The protesters also called on the US-led NATO coalition to immediately stop supplying arms to Ukraine and to work to resolve the simmering crisis through diplomacy.
Turning elsewhere now, Lebanon has reportedly approved the final draft of a deal with Israel that seeks to patch up Beirut's maritime dispute with the regime over a gas field in the Mediterranean. Lebanon's presidential office says the draft meets Lebanon's demands and protects its rights to natural wealth. The maritime agreement paves the way for the exploration of offshore natural gas reserves by Lebanon. Energy Minister Walid Fayyad says this will make Lebanon a petrostate. Israel has also described the agreement as historical. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah is yet to react, but it said earlier that it would agree to the Lebanese government's stance on achieving a maritime deal with Israel. Hezbollah has also warned the regime against looting Lebanon's natural resources. Our correspondent in Beirut, Maryam Saleh, recounts why the deal is significant for Lebanon, adding it's the first time Israel has succumbed to the demands of an Arab state.
We have three main issues here. Number one is that we have a deal. It's been very discreet, of course, but we know some details. We know that Lebanon will be given definitely 923, and Lebanon will also be given a potentially rich field called the Kana field, which goes beyond line 23. It's not just line 23, so we have something line 23 plus. In addition to that, we have assigned a clear confirmation from the United States that Lebanon may begin immediately to drill in its waters, and no one will come near that right, and no one will stop that right. So these are three very significant issues that we do know from sources, of course. This has been translated by a meeting today between Prime Minister Najib Mikati, the Energy Minister Fayyad, who met with representatives of the French petroleum company Total, and they have asked the company to begin directly to drill in Lebanese waters. So this is very significant for Lebanon. It is the first time, and as we hear from Israeli media, that this is the first time that the Israelis actually succumb to certain demands from a single Arab state and accept its demands for Line 23, which was something that we saw 11 years ago as almost impossible.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry has once again summoned the British ambassador to express its strong condemnation of the UK's, quote, interventions in Iran's internal affairs. The Foreign Ministry said Iran considers Britain's arbitrary sanctions as totally worthless and reserves the right to take reciprocal action. The UK imposed sanctions on Iran over what it called the violation of human rights during recent riots in the country. The UK sanctions target a number of Iranian police, political and security officials. The blacklisting will bar the individuals from travelling to the UK. The bans came after similar sanctions by the US. Tehran has slammed Washington's move by calling it the backbone of American-style human rights. Despite decades of Iranophobia, a new poll shows that the average American is incredibly supportive of diplomacy with Iran. 4 out of 5 Americans think Washington should pursue negotiations with Tehran. But the administration of Joe Biden has continued with his predecessor's maximum pressure sanctions campaign on the Iranian people. Ramin Mazahari reports from Chicago.
A new study covering a huge range of foreign policy issues found that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the United States should continue to pursue negotiations with Iran. On almost no other key foreign policy question is there such broad support across generations and political affiliations.
Most Americans are heavily fatigued by endless wars and, you know, U.S. Foreign policy adventurism overseas, and, you know, really want political leadership, regardless of which party we're talking about, that is concerned with, you know, more pressing domestic needs.
The study's authors even declared that politicians who criticize diplomatic efforts with Iran are out of step with many of their voters. Joe Biden campaigned on a diplomatic return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. In a major backtracking, not only has he not continued to uphold the United States' end of the deal, but he has imposed round after round of new sanctions on Iran. From the Washington Beltway to Hollywood, Iranophobia, Islamophobia, and violent belligerence towards Tehran has been pushed by America's political, media, and academic elites. However, the poll seems to prove that these messages have been emphatically rejected by the average American.
The level of sway that the defense industry has over Washington, the defense lobby, and the military-industrial complex, that's who the two major parties are beholden to. There's no real significant difference between the Republicans or the Democrats. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Iran deal. That's a perfect example.
The poll noted that for the fifth straight year, the percentage of Americans who think the U.S. should negotiate directly with adversaries has grown, now reaching 65%. Two-thirds of America supports the country's total withdrawal from Afghanistan. 40% of people declaring an opinion believe that the U.S. has not responded well to the unrest in Ukraine. The only foreign policy issue which gained as much support as diplomacy with Iran was that 80% of Americans demand more congressional oversight in the executive branch's ability to unilaterally declare wars. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
فبعزتك يا سيدي ومولاي أقسم صادقا لئن تركتني ناطقا لأضجن إليك بين أهلها ضجيج الآملين ولأصرخن إليك صراخ المستصرخين ولأبكين عليك بكاء
Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing this part of the Divine Kumail supplication. فَبِعِزَّتِكَ يَا سَيِّدِي وَمَوْلَايِ أُقْسِمُ صَادِقًا So by your might, my master and my protector, I swear sincerely, لَإِن تَرَكْتَنِي نَاطِقًا If you leave me with speech, لَأَضِجَّنَّ إِلَيْكَ بَيْنَ أَهْلِهَا ضَجِيجَ الْآمِلِينَ I will lament before you from the midst of the fire's inhabitants with the lamentation of the hopeful.
ولا أصرخن إليك صراخ المستصرخين. I will cry to you with the cry of those who are crying for help. ولا أبكين عليك بكاء الفاقدين. I will weep before you with the weeping of the bereft. ولو نادينك أين كنت يا ولي المؤمنين. And I will call upon you, where are you, O sponsor of the believers, يا غاية آمال العارفين, يا غياث المستغيثين, يا حبيب قلوب الصادقين, ويا إله العالمين. You are the goal of the hopes of your knowers. You are the aid of those who seek assistance, and you are the friend of the hearts of the sincere, O Allah of all the worlds. We said that one of the things Imam Ali alayhi salam is implicitly teaching us with this supplication, specifically this part, is the fact that we must be consistent in our prayers to Allah. Among the things that a supplicant should be careful about in prayer is that he should not lose that state of consistency in asking from Allah the Exalted. What is reflected in our books as Tarassul. And this is in fact the spirit of supplication. And it is that turning towards Allah, that beseeching and that entreating Him earnestly, that is the spirit of dua and supplication. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, from the beginning of this Kumail supplication, is not losing this state. And that is what the supplicant should do. Because it is in the state of consistently praying without constraint that one may experience within himself that kind of turning toward Allah. That is how the true supplicant will empower himself in getting himself closer to Almighty Allah.
Oh my Lord, I swear by your honor that if you will grant me speech in hell, I shall amongst its inmates cry out bewailingly unto you, like the cry of those who have faith in your kindness and compassion. And I shall mourn for you the lamentation of those who are bereaved, and I shall keep on calling unto you. Where are you, O friend of the believer?
Thank you, Allah, that we hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
One of the stories about a remembrance of the Almighty Allah and that consistency in praying is that of Buhlul and Harun. Once Harun was returning from Hajj pilgrimage, and he stayed in Kufa for some days. One day he was passing away when Buhlul called him by his name for three times. Harun was astonished and said, "Who is it that calls me by my name?" He was answered, "This is the insane Buhlul." So Harun asked Buhlul, "Do you know me?" And he answered, "Yes." Harun asked again, "Who am I?" He said, "You are the one who will be responsible and should account for an oppression done in the east, even if you are in the west yourself. You will be asked about it in the hereafter because you are the country ruler." So Harun wept a lot from sorrow and asked Buhlul, "What do you think of me?" Buhlul said, "Compare yourself with the Holy Quran. Most surely the righteous are in bliss, and most surely the wicked are in burning fire," the Holy Quran says. Harun said, "What about our deeds?" And Buhlul replied, Allah only accepts from those who guard against evil. إِنَّمَا يَتَقَبَّلُ اللَّهُ مِنَ الْمُتَّقِينَ Harun said again, but what about our tie of kinship with the Prophet? Sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Bahlul said, so when the trumpet is blown, there shall be no ties of relationship between them on that day, nor they ask for each other. This is what chapter Mu'minun says. Harun continued, but there is Prophet's intercession as we've been informed. But in response to that, Bahlul said, on that day, no one shall avail intercession except him whom the beneficent Allah allows. Then Harun asked him about his wish. Bahlul answered, forgive my sins and take me into paradise. Harun said, I don't have the power to do so, but I have been informed that you owe money to some people. Do you want me to pay your debts? Bahlul said, debts cannot be paid with debts. What you possess is people's belongings and you are obliged to return them to the people, to their owners. Harun stated, do you want me to order a life payment for you? Bahlul said, I'm Allah's servant and he, subhanahu wa ta'ala, gives me sustenance. And this is, I assume, the most important part of this story. He continues, do you think Allah remembers and protects you, but he forgets about me? That remembrance of the Almighty Allah is one of the key factors in our supplications. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In the mid-90s, the US was involved in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but that was a nuclear arms race. Now, however, Washington is fighting another Cold War, with China this time, and in the digital space, a fight for technological superiority. In late August 2022, Washington restricted sales of high-end and sophisticated chips to China and Russia. Top chip designers based in the US have even reported that they have been told to limit sales of their high-end chips. One of the manufacturers, NVIDIA, one of the largest graphical process unit makers in the world, has even revealed through an SEC filing that Washington fears there is a risk that the products may be used militarily in China and Russia. The US says the restrictions are aimed at keeping advanced technologies out of the wrong hands. Meanwhile, China has slammed the restrictions, stating that the U.S. is trying to impose a technological blockade. Beijing added that Washington aims to maintain its technological hegemony through the latest restrictions. The latest round of tensions between China and the U.S. could also present an explanation for Washington's increasing interest in Taiwan. The Biden administration has so far tried to further strengthen its ties with Taiwan, and this has been clearly demonstrated in many cases, the two most notable being top U.S. officials traveling there and Washington offering billions in subsidies to a Taiwanese company if it stops selling its advanced semiconductor chips to China. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, or TSMC, is the largest and most advanced chip manufacturing factory in the world, and Biden's push to stop the sales to Beijing only proves the U.S.'s aims that it seeks to impose a technological blockade and maintain or even strengthen its hegemony. The host of measures that Washington is taking to stop Beijing from getting its hands on high-end technology could amount to the biggest shift in U.S. policy on shipping technology to China since the 1990s. The expansion of U.S. powers to control exports of chips made with U.S. tools to China is based on a broadening of the so-called Foreign Direct Product Rule. This is the same principle that gave the U.S. authority to control the export of chips made overseas to Chinese telecoms giant Huawei Technologies, and later to stop the flow of semiconductors to Russia. But the question is whether this will be effective or will it backfire, similar to many other unilateral measures that the U.S. has taken over the past years. Some experts say Washington's move will set the Chinese back. But some, including top American officials in the U.S., say the unilateral controls being put into place will lose effectiveness over time, and the effort could backfire if other countries don't join Washington. The most recent U.S. blockade is aimed at preventing technology from being used by America's military rival. But these chips have a wide range of applications. Even if the blockade ends up being as effective as the U.S. wants it to be, it is only a matter of time before China begins manufacturing its own high-end chipsets, as well as semiconductors, and eventually becoming self-reliant. It started in February 2022, and there seems to be no end in sight. While the Ukrainian military has made some advances, Russia still controls some 20% of the country, and there's nothing that suggests that this war is winding down. The Ukrainian military is backed up by Western weapons and Western intelligence gathering, which tells them where Russian soldiers are and where their bases are located. In the latest in its long list of support for Ukraine, the U.S. Congress has passed another aid for Kiev, which amounts to some $12 billion, and this is on top of nearly $50 billion sent there in the past year. But apart from all the weapons, cash, and intelligence sent and given to Ukraine, reports are emerging that the U.S. has sent men on the ground there. A recent report released by an American news organization, The Intercept, stated that the U.S. Special Operations Forces are on the ground in Ukraine as part of a broad covert operation that includes CIA personnel. According to the report, before the Russian special military operation, the CIA believed Ukraine would fall quickly and so withdrew most of its forces and assets. But later on, as the war lengthened, the CIA began to believe that wouldn't happen, and Washington sent its covert assets back into Ukraine. But all this back and forth between Russia and Ukraine and the West's unilateral support for Kiev has given rise to a new crisis, one which doesn't only involve the two warring sides anymore, and that is nuclear warfare.
On Thursday, at a fundraiser in New York, U.S. President Joe Biden made an extraordinary and, as some say, highly alarming comments about the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war and the threat of a nuclear war. Biden said the risk of nuclear Armageddon is at its highest point since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. But the question which comes to mind is whether this admission is a result of the Biden administration's policy of supporting Ukraine in a war on Russia's border or Moscow's actions so far. Russian President Vladimir Putin has spoken out about using nuclear weapons, but never directly stated that he will use them. During his speech, however, Biden stated that Putin is not joking when he talks about the use of tactical nuclear weapons. The last time the U.S. was faced with such a situation was the Cuban Missile Crisis, which then President John F. Kennedy resolved through negotiations and striking a deal with Cuba. Biden, however, has so far shown no signs of walking back on its policies regarding Ukraine, and this has been clear in the U.S. not showing any interest in diplomacy and virtually cutting off all high-level talks. Not only this, Biden has time and again reiterated his support for Kiev, and the billions of dollars of aid is only a demonstration of the fact. Following the West's unconditional and unilateral support, Kiev has also pushed matters a step further and is now calling for strikes on Russia. Also, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, called for NATO to launch what he called a preventive strike on Russia to prevent Moscow from using nuclear weapons. But this has raised questions about Kiev's ambitions and the chances that the move would spark World War III and possibly a nuclear war. The Kremlin also responded to the comment and said Zelensky was trying to spark a world war. The remark gave birth to internal disputes in Kiev, with Ukrainian officials downplaying what Zelensky said. Now, as the world is faced with several economic, social, and environmental challenges, the warmongering aspirations of the US and its allies seem to have pushed humanity to the point of no return. But many, including Washington and Kiev, seem to be more focused on pushing their own agenda forwards, regardless of what's at stake.
As the crisis in Ukraine is getting worse, chances for a diplomatic solution to the war are looking slim. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has signed a decree that formally declares the prospect of any Ukrainian talks with Kremlin leader Vladimir Putin, quote, impossible. The decree also approves the decision of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council to strengthen Ukrainian defense. The decree came after Russia annexed four regions of Ukraine into its own territory. President Putin has just signed into law four unification treaties with the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics, as well as the Kherson and Zaporozhye region. Russia says Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics split from Ukraine in 2014 following what Kremlin describes as the Maidan coup. Russia's decision to incorporate the regions into its own territory comes amid reports of Ukraine's military advances. According to President Zelensky, Ukrainian forces have retaken dozens of villages from Russia in the east and the south of the country. However, the latest maps revealed by Moscow showed Russian troops had already left many areas in Kherson and northeastern Kharkiv region.
Тільки за цю добу на Херсонщині від псевдореферендуму було звільнено і стабілізовано такі населені пункти, як Нововоскресенське, Новогригорівка і Петропавлівка. Рух продовжує.
Ukraine is now trying to make further inroads in the south and east before the colder weather arrives. Russia is trying to deploy the 300,000 reservists called up in a partial mobilization 2 weeks ago. But that would take some time before it can be operational. The developments come as the U.S. is sending more weapons into Ukraine.
This morning, President Biden spoke with President Zelensky to underscore that the United States will never recognize Russia's purported annexation of Ukrainian territory and will continue to support Ukraine as it defends itself from Russian aggression. President Biden informed President Zelensky that the United States is providing a new $625 million security assistance package to Ukraine as they continue to defend their country from Russia's invasion.
The new $625 million military package approved by the Biden administration includes additional weapons and equipment, including HIMARS, artillery systems and ammunition, and armored vehicles. The United States has now sent Ukraine more than $16.8 billion in military hardware. Russia has now warned that the shipment of new military hardware to Ukraine will risk direct confrontation with the United States. The supply of military products by the U.S. and its allies not only entails protracted bloodshed and new casualties, but also increases the danger of a direct military clash between Russia and Western countries. Concerns are now rising over a possible nuclear confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has already warned that his threat to use nuclear weapons is not a bluff. The war in Ukraine has already caused a crisis for the European Union. Energy prices have soared and the rising cost of living is putting many Europeans into poverty.
We have now to limit this inflationary impact of gas on electricity and everywhere in Europe. This is why we are ready to discuss a cap on the price of gas that is used to generate electricity. This cap would also be a first step on the way to a structural reform, an overall reform of our electricity market.
There are now signs that the support for Ukraine amongst Europeans is dropping. A survey by Opinions pollster has revealed that 60% of EU's population were on board with sending weapons to Kiev. The number was 64% back in March. It now appears that the lingering crisis in Ukraine could lead to social unrest across the continent. European leaders are concerned over the rise of far-right groups which could potentially create cracks within the anti-Moscow coalition in Brussels.
Back in April, a temporary UN-mediated ceasefire was reached between Yemen's Ansarullah movement and the Saudi-led coalition. It was renewed twice, leading to a respite from a bloody war that has ravaged the country for years, killing 150,000 people. The Saudi kingdom and its allies, most notably the United Arab Emirates, have been waging a war against Yemen since March 2015, trying in vain to reinstall the exiled Saudi-friendly regime of Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi. The military campaign, which has been enjoying arms, logistic, intelligence, and political support from the United States and some other Western countries, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and turned Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Now, the truce has ended, with sides failing to reach a consensus about the renewal of the ceasefire. In a statement, the Ansarullah movement has blamed the impasse on the Saudi-led coalition's failure to live up to its commitments and its reluctance to address humanitarian issues as a top priority. It also slammed Saudi Arabia and its allies for their refusal to talk about measures that would alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni people. Yemeni Foreign Minister Hisham Sharaf Abdullah also said the other side's failure to respond to the purely humanitarian demands presented by Sana'a has confirmed, beyond any doubt, its lack of seriousness in moving towards reaching a comprehensive and sustainable peaceful political settlement. Meanwhile, Yemen's armed forces have put oil companies operating in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on notice, warning that they could be targeted as long as Riyadh and its allies fail to commit to a proper ceasefire. Sana'a says the coalition has repeatedly violated the humanitarian and military armistice. On April 10th, only a week after the agreement came into force, the Saudi coalition committed over 1,600 violations, including offensive operations, airstrikes, overflights by warplanes, spy planes, and Apache helicopters, as well as missile and artillery targets, resulting in the death of a number of people. And until the end of the ceasefire on October the 2nd, the number of violations of the coalition forces has reached over 34,500. So, apparently from the very beginning, Riyadh and its allies were not serious and honest about efforts to end the war. UN has expressed its disappointment with the failure to extend Yemen's truce, saying negotiations are underway for a potential extension to the ceasefire, urging calm on the warring sides. But what will happen if the fighting resumes? The ceasefire has brought a sharp drop in fighting in the war, but now millions will once again be at risk of air strikes, ground shelling, and missile attacks. Also, with the ceasefire in place, the daily lives of the Yemeni people dramatically improved. Fuel imports into the port of Hodeidah have quadrupled, while more essential goods entered the blockaded country and prices came down. In addition, the international charity Save the Children said the truce had led to a 60% decrease in displacement and a 34% drop in child casualties in Yemen. The Saudi-led military campaign had caused the internal displacement of 4.3 million Yemenis by March 2022. Humanitarian organizations have called on both sides to extend the arm of diplomacy, pointing out that 8 to 23 million people out of a total population of 30 million will be severely affected. So, if the humanitarian and military armistice is not renewed, everything will go back to square one. The risk of a large-scale famine, violence, collapsing services, and protracted displacement are the biggest challenges in Yemen now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, preventing the loss of other people's lives. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of preventing the loss of other people's lives. What do we mean by other people's lives is that sometime, due to our own actions, our planning, our thoughts, the way we socialize with the people, we take people's time and they're wasting their life by spending that time with us. Maybe as a teacher, when I'm teaching, I'm taking the time of my class and there I spend some time, some hours with my students, which is the waste of their life. And they're losing the time which they could spend in some other case or in some other things, which is better for them. Therefore, I must prevent the loss of other people's lives. I must prevent and not to allow myself to waste their lives in spending those hours with me if it is not useful. Therefore, it is very important. For example, as a speaker, when a speaker comes on a stage, he delivers a speech for 1 hour, but the people who are in front of them, maybe there are 10 people. So when you multiply 10 with 1 hour, it's 10 hours. I have taken 10 hours from the social life. These were the 10 useful hours. Did I give a message? Did I did something which was useful for them? Did they gain anything from the speaker when they were attending the speech of a specific person or not? Therefore, it is very important that we prevent the loss of the people's life. And if we can think about things like this, then obviously we are scheduling our life in a way that it is always useful for the others, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of preventing the loss of other people's lives. And we said that due to us, there might be some cases where the people's life are wasting, the people are wasting their life. Therefore, we should not do something and we should prevent from performing such actions, from performing such things. And I said that the better example is the example of a teacher or a speaker, that when they take time off the people, we need to see whether they are spending it as a useful time or not. For example, we can see our generations are deviated. It is only because that maybe in the house, parents are not attentive towards their kids. But on the other hand, there is a big burden on the shoulders of the teacher and the school and the university where they go and study. So when they're spending that time over there, and if teacher is unable to train the kids, unable to provide the tarbiyah to the kids who are there for him with him for 1 hour, maybe for 4 hours, or the school when they have these kids for 6 hours, less or even more, then what are they providing them? How they are training them? And this is very important that we should look at our life in this way. We know that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, he was the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution. And therefore, he had put specific time for a couple of things. For every single action, he had specific time and he wasn't wasting the time. Even when he used to teach, there was a specific time. And after that, neither before that nor after that, he used to take time off the students. Even when he became the supreme leader for 9 to 10 years, when he was in Jamaran, he had a specific time that at the 10 o'clock, dot 10 o'clock, he used to start meeting people, and not even after that. So he wouldn't accept it if people were not coming, if those who were had appointment. So therefore, it is very important to be punctual and not to waste others' time so that they are not losing their lifetime, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.